Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Blaser from GameWisdom.com. Welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast, where we examine the art and science of games. We got a great cast for you. Tonight, we have a first-time guest for these podcasts. This is someone who I met at GDC. I think this was like 2011, 2012. It's been so long. I can't remember. But she is a great designer. She is the co-founder of Metanet Software, who you probably know as the creators of the N series. Please welcome to the podcast, Mare Shepherd.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
It's great to finally have you on, Mare. I know we were speaking about this, wow, when I started the whole Game Wisdom thing, I think it was like 2012, 2013. So it's great to finally be able to get you, get the time right and all that.
Yes, thank you for keeping in touch. We've had a pretty busy time, so It got a little hectic there for a bit, but it's finally slowed down a little, so I have a bit more time.
Awesome. And it's always great to reach out to developers like yourself, and it's one of the things I love about these casts. We can have really great conversations. It's always just tricky nailing down those times. Very recently, I spoke to a developer from South Korea, and then a few weeks before that, I spoke to someone in India.
And oh, wow.
It can get crazy with the time zones. I know you're located, I think, in Canada, where I think we're on like the same time zone, so it's not that bad. But it's always fun when you're playing something like at 8 o'clock 8 o'clock Eastern, when it's like 7 o'clock in the morning the next day.
It's true.
All right. So to get the ball rolling, then, Mayor, since this is your first time on the cast, could you talk a little bit about yourself and kind of the background of your studio?
Sure. So I have been making games for, quite a long time. I started making games, you know, kind of playing around with games when I was a kid. So when I was maybe 8 or 10, just like playing around with code, and it was all new to me. But my family lived in a really small town just outside of Toronto, and there wasn't really a whole lot to do there. But they always managed to have a computer in the house because my parents were teachers. Mm-hmm. So that kind of opened up a lot of possibilities for me, because you can do pretty much whatever you want with code. So that's where I got intrigued by coding and making games and just kind of thinking about it. But I really got into it in university, which was in University of Toronto. I started there in 1998, so a really long time ago, but I started making games in art class, and they just gave you the freedom to, you know, make art in whatever medium you want. And that was really exciting to me because I loved digital art and I loved programming and, you know, the technical problem solving side of making games, but also that expressive creative side of it. So like almost immediately it felt right to me. And then I met Reagan in first year Java programming class. Reagan is the other half of Metanet Software. And we both sort of bonded over that, I guess, love of games, but also we didn't really like application programming, which was what we were learning at the time, because it's super boring. We both kind of realized that we have a lot of tools at our disposal. Reagan makes music, and we both really love, you know, working on game design and all of the different parts of games that, you know, come together to make this really cool thing. And we thought, I don't know, maybe we can play around with this and see if there's something here that, you know, we can build careers out of. So we formed Metanet Software in 2001, and we incorporated in 2004. And then we made N, and we were just kind of experimenting with things, and we finally went full-time in 2007. So it's been kind of there have been a lot of really high points and a lot of really low points, and it's a difficult industry to be in, as I'm sure you've heard from many, many developers. But it's just a way for us to develop skills in many areas and improve the skills that we already feel like we have. So we love that. It can be different every day, which is really interesting.
Yeah. And that's something I hear from a lot of the developers who I've spoken to on the cast. I think it's one of the amazing things about the industry is that there really is no textbook or checklist way to get in. We hear all kinds of stories. I keep saying this on the cast, but my favorite one will probably be the Robot Loves Kitty developers and how they lived in a treehouse, I think, for 2 or 3 years to
Wow.
finish their first game.
That's awesome.
And it's always great, again, talking to developers like yourself, Mayor, especially with the fact that you guys have been around. You said the studio was started in 2001, and then you
Yep.
went, and then and was released in 2005.
2004,
is my mistake. And that's one of the strange things about this industry, is that it really does move very fast. That transition from 90s to the end of the last decade, I mean, it's just phenomenal just how quickly things have gone. Like, I was watching on YouTube, like teens playing, like, older games, and they had, like, no idea what cartridges were, and I got to feel, like, really old again when I heard that.
Oh, yeah.
And especially the last decade, since Metanet Software started in the right at the beginning of it, I mean, the last 10 years, with the rise of Steam, with digital distribution, the whole thing, it's really changed how the industry and game development has grown.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So when we started in Toronto, there weren't really that many game developers. There was one kind of larger developer that we knew of, but there were no AAAs. And because, you know, the internet was relatively new and games were relatively new, I mean, relatively, it was hard to find other people doing the same things that we were. Like, when we were in university, we tried to make games in the computer science department, but our professors there said that they were much more interested in working on things like, you know, I guess more, they're interested in not making real-time rendering. They're interested in just, you know, giving things the time that it needed. So they weren't really interested in games as a medium because it didn't feel like a real computer science thing, which is, I mean, from that perspective, I suppose, whatever, that worked for them. But now, of course, there's a huge games department. But anyway, so it was a lot harder to do what we wanted to do. But at the same time, there was that spark of, yeah, we're doing something really interesting and kind of groundbreaking. And as we started to meet other people in Toronto who were interested in that, like Cappy, and we met Queasy Games, and it was just like there was this really exciting moment where we were all figuring out what we were doing and figuring out that it was really, really interesting. There were so many possibilities and yeah, so much ground to be broken. So when I compare that to now, when there are so many companies, there are some AAA companies in Toronto now too, but there are just so many indies and so many artists who are using games as a medium, and it's just like there's this vibrant, imaginative current running through the city that is so cool to be around. And it's just, yeah, I mean, I love that we've been in Toronto for long enough to see that evolve and to really meet so many interesting people. But yeah, it's, I can't wait to see where it's going to go next is the thing.
Yeah, I mean, I had the same experience as you, Mayor, when I was in college back in mid-thousands, where my school didn't have any video game-related programs, anything like that. And they were actually going to phase out their computer degree or computer track as I was graduating. And then I got in touch with them like 2 years, 2-3 later, because I couldn't find a job. I was trying to touch it. Oh yeah, we now have a video game department. I'm like, really? You wait until after? Did it start like the day after I graduated? Is that how it worked?
Right.
But and like right now, like my own little slice on the East Coast, like it's, I see or I hear like a lot of like smaller indie developers. I see like bits and pieces, but the East Coast still isn't as big or as predominant as the West Coast of the United States for game development. At least not yet. But as you were just saying, Mary, you never know what the future is going to be, especially in this industry.
Definitely.
And another great thing about this cast and doing the whole Game Wisdom thing is being able to reach out to developers internationally. Of course, not just Canada. I've spoken to developers in London, Brazil. I've said earlier, India, South Korea, I even spoke to someone from Australia. And again, it's always fascinating to hear all these different stories. And again, all these different ways that these studios have started.
Yeah, and it must be really interesting to see how different each kind of dev scene is in each city or each country.
Yeah.
That's cool.
And it also goes back to game design and talking about like mechanics in the industry. One of the things I've loved and I've definitely have made a name for myself is being able to analyze mechanics and design. And it's always fascinating to look at these different games. And again, there is no set structure for, what is a platformer, what is a first-person shooter, what is anything. So everyone has their own unique interpretation on that. And that has really blossomed thanks to the indie scene. And again, this is something, as we were just saying a few minutes ago, Mayor, with Men, that with this company being founded in 2001, we really didn't see the independent scene explode until I think it was like 2007, maybe 2008, 2009, like around that area, when the likes of Braid, Super Meat Boy, and just like the rest of the industry took notice of the independent market.
Yeah, a lot changed around then. It was pretty explosive, I guess.
Yeah, and it's just very interesting about how much the independent scene has really taken the ball and ran with it, in a manner of speaking, in terms of being able to approach these designs and systems that you wouldn't see either done in the same way or as creative among the AA or AAA studios. And we've talked about this on the cast several times, but a lot of AAA studios just don't have that freedom or that luxury to just say, you know what, let's make something completely screwball, something that, we don't know this is going to work. Let's just, throw 20 guys at it. That would never happen in a studio of, 60, 70 people with like millions of dollars of budgets.
Definitely. I really love that about indies also, that we can just be weird and risky, and we don't have to do games that make like a ton of business sense if we're passionate about the ideas and we really want to see it through to the end. I mean, obviously, if we want to run a business or we want to be able to stay alive, we do have to make some money, but we don't have to throw everything into one project, and it doesn't have to be as hit-driven as the AAA industry is. We can do things that have, maybe smaller appeal, more niche appeal, but they still can sell enough to get us by. At the same time, we get to, expand on these really interesting, odd, unusual ideas that we maybe have. I just think that that freedom is so, it's such an interesting tool, and I'm glad that people are taking advantage of it, because it also is really brave of people to put themselves out there, like to make something that has a ton of emotion, and you're vulnerable when you put something out there that really means something to you. And it's fantastic that we're in a space that has some leeway for that, like has some appreciation of those ideas. It's not perfect yet, and obviously there's lots of room to grow, but it's, to me, it's a very exciting time that people can do that.
Yeah, exactly. And like going back to the AAA industry, like I read these stories of where they say like, if this game doesn't sell 3 million copies, it's not considered a success. And then I look at like independents who say, we just sold, 200,000 copies. It's a miracle. I can't believe it happened. And
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
always that there's always that strange disconnect between like the AAA side on one hand, and then on the complete other hand, we have the independent scene. And as you were just saying, Mayor, that freedom to create and to make something that is uniquely you has definitely been a cornerstone of the independent scene. And I mean, it really just circles back again to how great it is to talk to developers like yourself with all these different stories, all these different experiences. And we would never see that, or I would never be even able to have these conversations with developers if we just stuck strictly to AAA or AA markets.
Right, exactly. There's just so much more variety. And yeah, I mean, I think that there's definitely, obviously, there are people, players have a lot of different tastes. And so I feel like it's nice that you can, if you want to play a AAA game, there are people making those. That's great. But if you want something that's a bit more personal, there are those coming out as well. And I don't know, I feel like the umbrella term that is games can satisfy a whole lot of different tastes. And although there are definitely still, like I'm sure that you've probably heard from other developers too, that perhaps their games have gotten some flack from sort of gamers who really prefer the standard first-person shooter type experience from AAA. And so they get a little bit of, their games aren't maybe held as highly as those in some circles, but then there are other circles where they are. And I just think that's beautiful. I'm so happy that there are players who want more than that and are actively searching it out.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought it up, Mayor, because that was taking me into my next question for you. As you said a few seconds ago, regarding how developers can really inject their own personality, their own experience into these games, we've seen a lot of games really go for more of the artistic side of storytelling and narrative-driven compared to, you know, the AAA, very mechanic or system-heavy games. Just a few examples off the top of my head, we have Gone Home, The Stanley Parable, Dear Esther, and even stuff like visual novel games like Analog, A Hate Story. And as you were just saying, I've definitely have read the comments. I've seen gamers go about that. You know, they call them, quote unquote, they use the term walking simulator as a derogative right. statement. And it's, again, the umbrella has just really expanded. I mean, hell, 10 years ago, who would have thought the whole mobile scene was going to explode as big as it would, and the casual game development has changed the landscape as well. Farmville, Clash of Clans, and et cetera, et cetera. And that definition of what is a game is becoming harder and harder to nail down.
Definitely, which I completely agree is interesting and much, I think, more progressive than otherwise.
I think
the idea of, because now we're asking, like, what is art and how do games relate to art? And realistically, we've been asking this for a while, and it will probably take a while longer to figure out what we really think it is, but it's finally sort of being closer. Games are closer to being seen as a genuine artistic medium, yeah. which I really appreciate, because I think that, yeah, people are doing things with games now that are, and have been for a little while, but I just mean there's more of an appreciation for it now, that are, you know, envelope pushing and are getting to places where it takes more than just good reflexes to be able to appreciate them. Yeah. But I think, too, the definition of what art is very complex and very layered, and it's kind of a big umbrella term, too. When we were making N++, which is not obviously a, you know, a typical what people would describe as an art game, it certainly has aspects of that draw from our artistic backgrounds, and as is probably obvious, the graphics are very minimal and unlike what you find in many other platformers. Yeah. And like when we made N, it was in we designed the graphics with that minimalist aesthetic as a counterpoint to all of the high poly, you know, super realistic detailed graphics that are prevalent in AAA. But with N++, we just wanted to kind of double down on that and refine it even further, because that's what we appreciate as artists. I mean, we love a lot of different types of art, but this is one that we felt was kind of underrepresented. And I think that's the beauty of making games with that kind of artistic and passionate expression, that you get to choose what you love and focus on. You get to try to introduce people to things that maybe they didn't understand before, maybe they didn't appreciate before. We really try as developers to help introduce people to new things and help them understand a bit more about why they're cool. So, like, I love minimalism, and by packaging it in a really, you know, deep and exciting platformer, I'm hoping to engage players that really love that challenge and just kind of subtly influence them a little bit to the beauty of minimalism. So I think that what art means to each developer is completely different, and what we're doing with that perspective is completely different too. And again, I just think that it's so great that we're at a point in the game industry that we can do those things.
Definitely. And that's another great thing about the independent scene, is that you really do see a lot of games go for that unified foundation between aesthetics and design. When you see something that, again, is just uniquely that game. A recent example that would be the game Duskers, that was just released off of Early Access, which whole game...
It's a great game.
I know, I'm loving it. It actually gave me a small heart attack playing it. So that's the first time in 10 years that the game made me jump like that.
Wow.
And For those of you who haven't heard our previous cast about or seen my videos, the whole game is done with a dirty tech aesthetic. So it's in the future, but you're looking at consoles and interfaces from like 1980, like DOS command prompts, stuff like that. And it's one of those games that you would never see someone do this in a AAA market, because the idea, again, is too experimental. It's not something mainstream. But
definitely,
when you play it, it's one of those games where everything clicks. Another example that would be my favorite game of 2015, Renowned Explorers from Abbey Games, which went for this roguelike exploration game with a very animated, very visually striking art style. And again, it all fits together. And this goes back to when I had a conversation with Ernest Adams. I think that was in 2014 or early 2015, where we just basically said that really good games, it basically, everything works. There's harmony in a really great game where everything fits in. Nothing seems like it was just added just for, you know, shits and giggles. Nothing seems superfluous. And again, it goes back to what you were talking about with the End series, with the minimalistic style, that when you look at this game, it is distinctive End. No one can look at this game and go, oh, this just looks like 20 other platformers. It is uniquely your game and your design.
Thank you, yeah. And we, I mean, another... So I absolutely agree that when the design and the aesthetics and the sound and everything just works out, you're right. It feels great. Like, to me, those are the games that are the most satisfying to play. And I mean, I obviously I'm pretty biased, but I do feel like we achieved that with the End series as well, because the idea behind the graphics too was to put the focus on the gameplay, like to sort of pare back everything else in the game so that the gameplay really shone. And I think that's important, that in, if you're going to make a game that feels satisfying in every way, that is one of those games that really sings, you have to put that kind of thought into absolutely every aspect, because they're all interconnected, and that, I guess, the degree to which each affects each other part is really, really important.
Exactly.
It's often really subtle too, like you don't really know how the sound design is going to affect the atmosphere, and I guess we just do it through trial and error, but often you start with an idea and you just, you know, you, once you get the rest of the game to a point where you can actually see how it plays out and how it affects the rest of the game, it's a really powerful moment.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I've talked about on several articles here on Game Wisdom and on previous podcasts, where you need to get that core gameplay loop or that core foundation of your title, you know, figure it out, lock it down, and grow from there. Once you get to that aha moment where everything starts fitting, when the game feels like something you can enjoy, you can then start building upon that. And once you've got that locked down, then it becomes a lot easier to start saying, okay, now we know how the game's going to be, what's it going to sound like? Or what's it going to look like? Because you have that foundation to build on. And
definitely.
And time after time again, one of the telltale signs I see of a game or designer that's struggling is when they have to shift gears, like 25, 50%, or God-fearing 75% done a game, where they realize this isn't working, we need to completely redo this. And when that foundation doesn't work, it just infers on every aspect of your game.
Yeah, we really feel like it helps to be able to be flexible, like to, when you're making a game, to have a sense of where you want to go with it, but to allow some adaptability within that design so that you can change gears like that when you have to, like when you realize that that's what you need to do, at least you have the ability to do that. End started out as a stealth game. We wanted to make a, you know, stealthy ninja platformer, but mainly about stealth, and it was really slow paced and you would hide in the shadows and avoid these deadly robots that are patrolling, you know, the level. But we just sort of gave ourselves the opportunity to play with it a bit, and we allowed, when we were testing, we allowed ourselves to like up the speed a little bit and kind of run around the level instead of just always being stealthy. And that made it obvious that that's where we should really go. Like, it was so much more fun immediately. And if we'd had much more of a tie to our initial idea, like if we demanded that we make a stealth game, instead of letting it be what it wanted to be, I think we would have, I mean, obviously it wouldn't have been that successful because it was clearly less fun.
Yeah.
So yeah, that freedom to allow yourself to let the game tell you what it wants to be and then go for it is super important. But as you said, it is very difficult to change gears for sure. Because there's, you know, you've built this thing that's going in one direction. Now you got to change directions. Yeah, there's a lot to change. But yeah, if you can do it though, if you can let yourself have that opportunity, it can mean the difference between a game that you are satisfied with that is really something that you love and are proud of and something that, you know, it's okay.
Yeah, and that a period of refinement and iteration is such an important skill set for game developers, especially for not just game designers, but owners of their own studio. I've talked to several developers over the last few years, and about that stair refinement, I think the one thing that has stood out, or the number one lesson, is that no game ends exactly how it started. It's never going to be that way. You're never going to have your first idea be, you know, the perfect 10 out of 10, I love it for this game. It's always going to be growing and changing.
Definitely. I think one of the games that we worked on but didn't release was called Robotology, and we're hoping to get back to it someday, but that was definitely one of the mistakes that we feel like we made. We went into it with just too rigid a design, you know, expectation or design document, really, and when it started to not work, when we weren't able to solve some of the problems that we needed to solve to get it to that place, you lose momentum and you lose what's driving you towards it in the first place, and sometimes that can be killer.
I know, I've read horror stories, I even know a few devs who've had issues like that, where the whole project just starts to stall, and then you fall behind, and then it goes from being for momentum to just trying to dig yourself out of this hole that you've created. And for a lot of games, sometimes it just reaches that point where it just isn't worth it, and you're just trying to essentially plug up a hole in a sinking ship instead of trying to keep the, trying to get out. Like, at some point, you just have to, as the saying goes, kill your darlings.
Yep, definitely.
And that's always been one of the more interesting challenges, and especially talking with you, Mayor, and talking with a lot of developers about knowing when a project doesn't work. That's one of those things that we really don't hear a lot from the game industry, partly because a lot of what goes into game development is still pretty much behind doors. And then there's the other side that it's very hard to get information from a AAA developer. Like, I could never sit down with a AAA designer and ask, like, the same questions I would ask you or ask other independent developers. They would never be able to answer, you know, why do you decide not to do this? You know, they have NDAs and the publisher breathing down on them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I love about GDC, that they do the failure workshop pretty frequently, so that you get a chance to hear from developers and projects that they've worked on that just haven't gone the way they wanted them to. And I'm happy also that there is much more of a desire to share those stories with people, with other developers in general now, and we can do it pretty easily with Twitter and with, you know, like, we can just write our blog posts and then share them pretty rapidly and far, which is great, because it's important to hear that, because I think this is a really difficult industry, and thousands, you know, I don't know how many people, but let's say thousands of people are coming into it every year, and I don't want them to have stars in their eyes thinking all I need to do is X and then I'll be successful, or I'll make the game that I want to make and I'll, you know, fulfill the dreams that I have, because that's something you need to work towards. And it's a really, really rough road. And the more we hear from other developers about how they've failed or mistakes that they've made and how they've continued working, even despite all that, we need to paint a better picture for people who are coming into the industry, because I wouldn't want their hearts to be completely broken. I want to hear what they have to say. And I want them to have the strength and determination that they're going to need to get there.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that I was sort of setting out with Game Wisdom in mind, was to be that middle ground between designers and the industry and enthusiasts and students. Because as you were
That's
saying,
great.
and as I was saying, a lot of the stuff is rarely said unless for specific workshops. Like,
Definitely.
I mean, when, I guess, again, I get to date myself. I remember when, like, Tech TV and G4 first started and it was about talking to developers, looking at design, stuff like that. I thought that was amazing because like, there was nothing like that. And there still is very little along those lines, at least in terms of mainstream.
Right.
And that's why I'm hoping to build Game Wisdom and try to get to that point where it can become a source for everyone to start learning more about design and, again, about the inner workings of what goes into making a video game.
I think that's a really great goal. And I think that reaching other developers is fantastic, but if you can reach players too, that would be really helpful because a lot of times people don't really have a good sense of what goes into making games,
Exactly.
obviously. And it's important though to try to understand, when your favorite game that you've been waiting for is delayed, here's why, and maybe you have an empathy for the developers, or maybe you understand what the methodology is behind the decisions that were made, or the prices, or whatever, but that would be super helpful.
You'll enjoy the post I just made on the site. I think it was last week where I talk about three facts where fans get it wrong about game development, and one was pretty much just add multiplayer. You know how fans just go, "It's simple, just add multiplayer to your game. You can do that. You know, it's just like a 2-week process. Put it together, and it'll make your game will sell better. Just do it."
I will appreciate that because that's definitely one of the things that we've heard a lot, especially since N Plus did have multiplayer, but N Plus Plus does not have online multiplayer. It has local, but not online. So we've heard that a lot. Like it should be so easy, and we already did it, so it should be just, drag and drop your code in. And so while I understand the desire for players to have online multiplayer, what we learned with N Plus was it doesn't really work that well with this type of game because N Plus Plus is very precise. Like you need to have zero lag, and physically that's not possible. So we made a decision to try to improve the overall quality of the game, but we still hear that, oh, it would be better, and it's so easy to just add multiplayer that we should just do it. But yeah, it's so much more complex than that, and it's tough because we know we can't please everybody, but we want to make a game that everybody loves. But yeah.
Now here's
Anyway, thank you for your efforts.
Yeah, no problem. If you want, I can send you a link to that article too when we're done here.
Sure.
Here is a question that's a really good segue to this next question, Mayor, about sort of trying to please everyone and trying to get the information about what goes into game development. And one of the biggest, and quite frankly, just like shocking changes as someone who is older in the game development, is the fact of the pricing change that has happened to the game industry and game development over the last 10, well, I guess we can say about 10, 12 years from this point. Again, I get to remember when games were $70, $80, and you would buy maybe one game every 2, 3 months. Today, I mean, I can go on Steam right now and probably buy 15 games for $50, not to mention all the mobile games, all the free-to-play games. And I know a lot of people joke about how great we have all these sales. I know as we're recording this cast, I believe we are like 2 or 3 days away from the latest Steam summer sale. And but then there is the flip side. Again, this is one of the things that I've learned from talking to developers like yourself and reaching out with Game Wisdom, is that lowering your game's price to somewhere you think that it would sell better, but it's not making you money, is a huge decision. And again, every day you hear fans saying, "Oh, I'll buy your game when it's $3," or "Why don't you just lower your game $20? It will sell better." And there's just so many loops and so many backdoor decisions that go into making the price of a game. So I guess the long-winded question I want to ask you about, Marilyn, is again, as someone who has been working at your own studio, you've been doing for now about 15 years, and you've seen those changes both as a designer and as someone who plays video games. What are your thoughts on sort of this whole, like, the quote-unquote race to the bottom that is going on right now with game developers and pricing their games?
Well, it's definitely one of those, like, hot-button issues that we talk about a lot in game developer circles, and obviously we've heard about it a lot from fans, too. So we, I mean, N++ costs $20 on PS4, and that got some feedback, which is difficult because so from a developer perspective, you want to make sure that you're pricing your work in a way that makes sense. So you know what went into it, and you don't want to overestimate the value of that, but you do have to price it in a way that doesn't undersell you either. Because if you set the price too low, you can make your game look like cheap, or, you know, it's not worth much. And I think as the market gets more and more saturated, it is imperative that we make sure we're pricing our games with, you know, like, I guess, understanding that they are valuable, but that price point seems to fluctuate a lot. And, like, you can never really make everybody happy. There will always be someone who thinks your game is overpriced, even at $3, you know, a heavy, heavy discount on Steam. So from a certain perspective, there's not really a lot you can do. Whatever price you set your game, people are going to complain. But at the same time, there are people who will see your game as that valuable. So, I mean, from our perspective, we're just trying to make sure that for $20, you get a lifetime's worth of game. Like, that's basically all we can assure you, that this is high quality content. It will last you for hundreds of hours, and you can play it a bit a day for the rest of your life, and you'll be happy. That's what we're offering with our $20 price point, which we know is a little bit high, but we figure for 10 years of work, and, like, it's good. It's really good. Like, the levels are so good. We feel it's completely worth that. But that said, I know that I made it. Of course I think it's worth that. Like, if I didn't, what was the point of making it? So I do have to balance my own perspective as an artist and then my perspective as a business owner who needs money to live. And then I have to think about it as a fan too. Like, I played plenty of games, and when do I buy them? Do I wait until they're 80% off, or do I buy them on day one? And just between you and me, and I guess your listeners, I do buy them on day one when I can, because that's when I'm so excited about them. Like, I've been waiting for so long. I'm ready. Give it to me now. So I know that pricing comes from, so, like, the digital distribution aspect of games is relatively new, and we still kind of do operate under the retail model. So game comes out for $80 in the AAA world, and if you wait 6 months, you'll probably find it in a discount bin at 50% off or, you know, lower, whatever. And I think people expect that to extend to the digital realm too, which, I mean, there are pros and cons there. Like, it's certainly a relevant expectation, but also with digital distribution, there's no limit on how many number, you know, like, on the numbers of games that you can produce, because there isn't that physical copy aspect of it. But there are just so many things involved in pricing that at the end of the day, what we're planning on doing going forward is just kind of experimenting, like, setting what we think it should be, and then listening to the market and putting it on sale occasionally and seeing how people respond, or, like, listening to feedback from fans. Or I think that's all we can do, really, is try to estimate what we think it should be and then run some experiments, see what the market says. But it's very, overall, as a developer, it means I can't depend on anything. I don't know. I don't have enough data to really know how my game's going to sell and how I can make it sell better. So, it's a little, that's part of the reason that this industry is so difficult, because especially as more games get created, we're all in this boat. Like, nobody knows how we're going to do. Just kind of have to try things and see what sticks.
Yeah, and this is also one of those areas where I can feel that push and pull again as being someone between the developer and industry side and the enthusiast and gamer or enthusiast and student side. I mean, I know when I speak to developers like yourself and all around the world about the challenges of making a video game, and we've said several times on this cast, there is no set guidelines for how you make a game.
Yeah, definitely.
And I can understand that. I know when a developer prices a game at $20 or $30 or whatever, they're not sitting there, greedily stoking their fingers, going, "I'm going to steal all the money from all these people." That's where they feel their game is worth, and they feel they've put the time and dedication into that to make the game worth it that much. And then on the gamer side, I can see the fact that when you're just bombarded with games these days, again, I mean, I'm betting right now as we're talking, there's probably 20, 30 different games released right now on Steam,
Yeah,
probably
definitely.
another 40, 50 by the end of the day, and you're just being flooded with these games, and money is still tight for a lot of people. And I know there are people who they can't be spending $40 a day on games or even $20 a game. And it's always that push and pull, I think. I know there are people, there's of course the ever raging debate of piracy and people
Yep.
stealing games. Some of them do it for, means just to resell it or just to not help anyone. Then there are people who do because they literally can't afford these games or afford the pricing of these games.
Right.
And it's just an issue that just keeps growing and growing. And as you were just saying a few seconds ago, Mayor, regarding buying games day one, my whole buying mentality has certainly been altered over the last 10 years, and then the last 2, 3 years doing Game Wisdom. I can't remember the last time I bought a game day one, either because A, I play games on early access, B, I wait for a
Right.
press copy, or C, just because I have 20, 30 games staring at me on Steam that I haven't even touched, nor will I ever get to touch at this point. It's completely
Very
crazy
true.
about how things have just shifted. And again, I remember growing up when you buy a game, that was it for, a month, maybe 2 months. You're not buying anything else.
Right. That's what my experience was like growing up too, although we tended to rent games
Oh,
from like the
yes.
local video store for Genesis or whatever. But yeah, you wouldn't really see that many games in a year for sure. And now you're right. You can see hundreds a day if you want, brand new.
Yep, and again, I think this also circles back to what we talked about a few minutes ago regarding classifying these titles as games. I mean, over the last year alone, I've seen so many experimental and interesting titles. I saw that 88 Days, which is like a visual novel game. Again, Gone Home, Her Story, etc., etc. And it's even getting harder with this whole pricing to try and put a value on that. Like, what is the value of a good story? That's one of those questions that no one's going to really have the same answer to. When we again go back to like the AAA or the mechanics heavy thing, we have some kind of baseline in terms of, oh, you're going to get an 8-hour platformer or a 30-hour RPG. You can quantify that to some extent, but how do you quantify a game like Dear Esther or Gone Home? It's just
Right.
very hard. And Gone Home is, I think, another perfect example of that. I know when the game was launched, I think it was like $20, $24. And I remember reading on the forum people just like yelling, "How dare you price this walking simulator at $20? This should be like a dollar game or something like that."
Yeah. It's definitely, I mean, I think as a creator, it can be kind of well, it can be heartbreaking when you have put so much into this thing that you've made and you put it out there and you give it the price you think it deserves and you talk about it in the way that you think will help people understand why you've made it and what you've put into it and why that's important. And then to hear people say, "How dare you? This game is worth $2." Like, this is, it's tragic. It really, I mean, we, I think a lot of people need to develop a very thick skin in this industry, you know, you because you get that feedback a lot, all the time. No matter what you do, there will be someone who is very vocal about how much they hate what you've done. But the only saving grace is occasionally there are people who really get it and who really understand what you're trying to say and why you're trying to say it. And that's kind of, I mean, it's definitely something that you need to try to balance. Like I do the things that I do because I find them satisfying and I want people to play my games and I want them to enjoy them too. But ultimately I can't listen too carefully to the feedback that I get because it really hurts. Mm-hmm. Some of it's wonderful and that helps me keep going, but a lot of it is really destructive and, you know, it doesn't help at all. Mm-hmm. But the beauty of being able to make something that is interesting is, you know, it's just such a powerful thing to be able to do. I hope that creators keep doing that, even though they're going to get comments like, this game is terrible, you should kill yourself, whatever. But I mean, ultimately, I hope people stop saying those terrible things, but I don't have a lot of optimism in that department.
Yeah.
So all I can hope is that people keep making the things that they want to make because I enjoy them and other people will appreciate them. I just hope that's enough.
Yeah. And I mean, there are so many topics that we could go into, which it's definitely, as you said, a very tough industry, and it can be a very depressing industry sometimes. I remember, of course, when things got about, like, the EA Spouse incident, and when we started to first hear about the insane working conditions and the pressure and the grind, and a lot of people just pushing themselves past their breaking point to make a game. And I know this is a tangent that we could probably spend the next hour or two going over, but the whole one thing that annoys me when people try to justify these conditions with, you know, what's the expression? Suffering for your art kind of thing.
Yeah.
That always just really just rubs me the wrong way. When people say, oh, you should work 80 hours a week because then you don't really care about this to begin with. And that just really pisses me off. And it goes back to something that I've been learning and talking about with game development and with Game Wisdom, is that video games are very much, they're both art and a product. And you need to balance both in order to have any measure of success in this industry. If you just go into this with purely art and say, oh, I'm just going to work 100 hour a week, you know, I'm not going to do anything else, I'm going to kill myself and make this game, you're not really thinking in terms of a long-term development. And on the flip side, if you go into this purely from a product or profit point of view, then you get those very soulless games, very mechanical games that it feels like nothing creative was done in them, and then you're the opposite of what we see with the independent market. And again, with that explosion of creativity, and again, that freedom to create.
Yep, that's an excellent point. That's exactly it. It's an art and a business, and you absolutely must pay attention to the business side too. So even though it is heartbreaking to hear people say, this game is not at the right price point, you know, I don't want to pay that much for something that I don't see value in. Sometimes as a business owner, you have to say, okay, then, you know, even though it means more to me, or I perceive this thing as having more value than the market does, I will have to drop the price, or I will have to change the way I talk about it, or whatever it is. You got to make those tough decisions. Because I think ultimately, at the end of the day, we make games. We want people to play them because we think that they're enjoyable. They're worth playing. There's something in there that provides something to people. And we need to get it out there. We need to have them, you know, try it. And so I, you know, I really understand that while I don't want to support the race to the bottom, I certainly understand the desire to do whatever it takes to get people to play your game. And I think at the end of the day, although I think very carefully about every single decision with respect to that, I want people to play my game. I want people to enjoy it and see what I put into it. And I'm not gonna, you know, make decisions that hopefully I might, I mean, I'm hopefully not going to make decisions I might regret later, but at the same time, I really want to try to understand what people want from me and my games and how I can give that to them.
Yeah. And again, it is hard to do that. There are no manuals, there's no training for running your own studio, making your own game.
Absolutely. And further to that, what you're making is completely
Of
different. So,
course.
like the type of game you're making or the type of audience you're seeking is, they all have different rules and yeah.
Yeah, and if you try to approach one the same way as another, it can just seriously backfire on you. And we've seen cases where developers are trying, when they're essentially trying to force certain elements into their games that the fans don't want, and it
Right.
just infuriates them. A good example recently would be like Payday 2 when they add in microtransactions. And again, it's one of those things that in the middle position that I'm in, I can see things from both sides where the
Right.
publisher and developer are trying to make more money to make more kind of make this game better. And then you see from the gamer enthusiast side where they're basically trying to double or triple dip on this game, you know, boo
Right.
them or, you know, far worse language than that. And going back, you were just saying a few seconds ago regarding every game being different. A great example of that, and one game that I really did enjoy, was Stardew Valley, which the whole story of that game was he worked on this game like by himself for 2 years to put out this game that he wanted to make. And that, again, is what I love about indie developers. You're making these games not because someone's, you know, pushing a button and saying, we need a platformer. You're making this because this is something that you want to see happen.
Right. Yep, that's a fantastic point.
So far, Mayor, this has been a fantastic cast, and as I was saying a few seconds ago, we could easily spend 3, 4 hours talking, and those are always my favorite kinds of casts, but I know people tend to start to get tired around hour 2, hour 3, and I would
Right.
say the best part, the best sign this is a great cast, the fact that we are just under an hour in terms of recording. We haven't even gotten to your game yet. We've just been talking about design and the industry. Before we get to talking about your game, I have one more industry topic I want to ask you about your thoughts about, and then we'll talk more about N itself. Now,
Okay.
over the last few minutes, we've been talking specifically about pricing and about the push and pull between developer and enthusiasts. And one area where that has definitely been the strongest and probably the most concerning would be the state of the mobile industry. And have you released N to the mobile scene yet?
No. So, I mean, N specifically doesn't feel like a great fit for mobile because it is very precise. And the you need the haptic feedback of buttons because it's very immediate. So you don't want to have to think about pressing a button. You want to know immediately that you've done it so that you can focus on everything else you need to focus on. So mobile does not have that capability at this point, and I am not interested in putting out a game where the experience is not great for players. So that's why, even though we get emails every single day about when it's coming out on iOS or whatever, but I can't do it until there's a better framework for the design of the game because it doesn't work right now. But anyway.
And I'm really glad you brought that up, Mayor, because I think really infers on this next topic. Because I have spoken to developers who are both yay and nay on the mobile development scene, and you just had a really good point about that tactile feel of button pressing
Yeah.
is required for certain games. And the last time I played, I think one of the N games, I think this was on Xbox Live Arcade, so it must have been at least 5, 6 years. Well, actually, probably more than that at this point. I get to feel even older. But with like the platformer genre in particular, you need that tactile feeling of the button. Again, different button presses elicit different reactions from the character, tapping it, holding it, etc., etc. And that's one of the things that you just don't see with a touch interface. And this goes back to a conversation I had with developer Rahul Sehgal from Roche Interactive with his mobile game, Bird of Light. And he had a different issue. Instead of the fact that his game was a tactile sense that it wasn't going to fit, he had issues with it from a design sense that he was having issues with pitching it. The publishers didn't want a game that was this complicated or this involved. And so he decided to switch it to the PC, which I think it should be coming out relatively soon on Steam. But that the difference between the mobile and like PC slash console markets have really grown drastic over the last 5 years. I mean, we're seeing a lot of cases. The issue of cloning, for example, has been very prominent. And as you're just saying, with a game like N, like a game like that, if you put that out on the mobile, it wouldn't feel as right as it would on the PC or with a actual gamepad or controller in your hand. And there's definitely those concerns that the mobile market just isn't sustainable. Now, obviously, you don't have a first-hand account or first-hand opinion on that, but as someone who has been a part of the game industry, what are your thoughts on like the mobile development scene? I guess just as someone who's been like working in this field.
Well, I mean, so although N is not a good fit for mobile for the reasons that we've discussed, mostly the touch screen, there are plenty of ideas that are a good fit, that use that specific environment to its advantage. And I think every game developer probably has a couple that they would really love to try. But the problem for my company is that because so many games, something like 100 plus come out every single day, it's even worse in terms of getting noticed and getting recognized. Like, that is like, I'm happy in a sense that people are able to put out so many games, that people are developing so many games. That's awesome. And I hope that plenty of them are brand new and are saying things that are really interesting and all that good stuff. But on the other hand, that is a huge, very saturated market that if you're you have to weigh the cost of development. Are you going to be able to recoup that? Are you going to be able to reach the audience that you want to reach when there's that much competition? So, especially since the I think they call them premium games now. Anyway, games that you just outright pay for that aren't free to play on mobile are steadily decreasing in favor of the free to play model. It makes it even harder because let's say we have this great idea that would work so well on my phone. Now I also have to integrate all these free-to-play concepts if I think I can, if I want to sell it, if I want to make sure that I can make money from it. And sometimes those two ideas are completely at odds. So it makes you either go down the path of thinking about great ideas for touchscreens and for handheld games or for mobile, or you go down the path of thinking about making money and the free-to-play model and how you can kind of reap the benefits of that. And I guess as a developer who kind of prefers the former, who prefers to think about the game design first and think about what would make a great game, not what would make a game that will definitely sell, it's tough. And some ideas just are not a good fit, and we have to think about where we want to put our development time. So, although it's a market I would love to get into, I don't know that we will, because unless we're doing, like, unless we are lucky enough to get a grant or some way to cover the entire cost of development so that we don't have to use this product as a way to sustain our business, which is like a pipe dream. I just don't know how we can do it without suffering a huge cost. And that to me is pretty tragic. Like, if I was just cloning something and churning something out and it was, at no development cost to me, I guess that could be a good business model. But like you said earlier, you don't really have a lot of soul in that. There's no, it's not helping me as a person do the things that I want to do in life. It's not helping provide value to the world of, people who want to play interesting games. So I don't see a point. So it's tough. And I understand that we all kind of have to constantly reconsider what we're doing to make money and how we're going to sustain our businesses because the scene is rapidly changing. And I think Nintendo obviously is trying to reconstruct what they do and regroup a bit. But I have to say, I'm a little worried about their new free-to-play models too. Like, I love Animal Crossing. I loved it on the 3DS. I'm so worried that they're going to ruin it with the free-to-play model on mobile, but I guess that's the future, so I guess I have to accept it. But as a player, I don't love
Yeah.
it.
And so many good thoughts to unpack there about mobile, especially about these polarizing thoughts. And when I spoke with Mike Lee from Fake Dice, and again, Raul Segal from Roach Interactive, who had those troubles again with trying to approach their games from mobile versus a more stable or a bigger market with the PC and console, it's the same thing. Like, when you go to the mobile, a lot of publishers expect you to add those little things to it, in-app purchases, ads between levels, stuff like that. And again, it's that push and pull between, do I want to make a product that I'm proud of, something that I love, or do I want to make something that's very sold or very marketed towards just making money? And for a lot of people, it's definitely becoming more of like of a serious discussion for game developers. And when I think about, again, from my own point of view, it's one of the things that has really kept me out of the mobile state of things and has me really worried about it. I spoke to, oh man, I can't believe I forget his name. He gave a speech at a Couch Connect where he just basically ragged on the whole state of mobile development. This was like a year or so ago. And he also had the same thoughts as me that it's just not a sustainable way of looking at things. And going back to what I said a few minutes ago regarding people who look at the video game industry, as suffering for your art, how that annoys me. Another thing that really annoys me is when I read these stories or reports about people, talking about the virtues of in-app purchases and treating your consumers like whales and all the ways you can get money from them. That also really bothers me from the opposite side, when you're treating it solely as a very soulless, commercial-driven market, and just leads to products suffering because of it.
Definitely.
Oh, I, yeah.
Yeah, I take offense to the words whales
Yeah.
also. I don't want to think about my players that way. And I it's a little disturbing that people are okay with
Yeah.
that, in my opinion.
Yeah, like when I read a, or I saw a presentation where someone was saying about if you own more than 80 games on Steam, we don't care about you, or something like that. That just drove me up a wall that whole day when I was thinking about, like, talking about games that way and basically just devaluing the market as a whole, saying unless your game is a mobile in-app purchase heavy game, then it doesn't really matter today. And oh yeah, that just really got on my nerves. And I know this is one topic that we're basically talking from the outside in. Me, as someone who analyzes games, and you, who focuses right now at least on the PC or console, I think, again, because of the design of N. So it's hard for us to have, like, the, on the front lines kind of deal. But we have heard stories about this, the whole Monument Valley escapade that happened last year when they got, like, yelled at and worse because they dared to charge, $2 for an expansion pack. And again, that's something as traditional console and PC gamers, I mean, that sounds perfectly reasonable to me. I mean, hell, I spend like 10, I'm sorry, it's like $6, $7 per pack for like Payday 2 stuff, and of course, $10, $20 on expansions. And again, it's just that weird thing, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the cast with trying to properly educate people on the state of game development and design, that there are people who don't understand why all games shouldn't be free to play, or why, how dare you expect to charge, $1 or $2 on your game. And as you were saying a few minutes ago, there's also that debate about quote unquote premium prices for mobile games. Like, how if you dare to price your game at like $4 or more, no one will ever look at it, kind of thing.
It's really rough out there. Because, I mean, as we've been discussing, you do want to get your game out to the most players you can. Like, you want to make sure that people play it because there's huge value in that. But in my opinion, you don't want to just give it away. And this is coming from a person who did give her first game away and is completely free. But we've added so much to it and we've refined it so much more that we think it is worth charging for. So there's this delicate balance between you want to give people as much as you can, but you also need to run your business and for us, we want to make money to make more games. We don't want to be rich. We don't care about that. We just want to be able to continue doing what we love. So it's you have to price it right. And what right is in constant flux, depending on the industry you're in or the market or the everything. And it's really, you're right. There's no right answer.
And it's just one of those things that it's that we are going to need to find an answer to that at some point, or it's only going to get worse. And I just remember a discussion I had with John Schaefer when he was talking about at the gates pricing, and it was, I think, going to price it like at $30, $35, and like that's where he feels worth it, and that's where he felt the market was. And he knew a game like that, no matter how much he would want it to go on mobile, it would never ever fit on a mobile platform. Because again, unless he's willing to, slice his game up into little pieces and sell it at like $2 or less, it would never work. And the fact that there are those discussions and about having to break your game down like that just really speaks as a problem indicative of the mobile platform at the moment.
Definitely.
Whew, well, we keep going, but just a lot of great conversations. And I know you probably have to get going at some point today. I don't think you have 8 hours to talk to me. So, to start to wrap things up, let's talk a little bit about what's going on with Men at Software right now. And that is, of course, the upcoming release of the latest version of N. So,
Yeah, so right now we're working on N++ on Steam. So it's going to be out for PC and Mac and Linux this summer. We're not exactly sure when yet because we so it came out on PS4 last July, and we've been since then working on porting it to Steam, but also adding some new things. So we had a bit of trouble with our programmer, so it really should have been out a lot sooner, but unfortunately, circumstances didn't allow that. So we're just sort of catching up now, but we have a lot of cool stuff that we wanted to add to the game for launch on PS4 even, but you just run out of time during development. There's always so much to do, and we were a little overexcited, I guess, to add all this cool stuff. But anyway, we're finally getting to it. It's finally coming out on PC, and I think, yeah, this is kind of what we've heard from fans is that this is where it needs to be. They're happy that it's out on PS4 and it's reaching a new audience there, but fans of N from way back in 2004 have been asking us for years, over 10 years, when we're going to bring one of the Plus versions to PC, where it sort of began. And we're finally doing that, which is so exciting.
And I know, I think like the first time I actually sat down and played and like actually owned, I think, as I said, it was for XBLA. And as you said, it has been mostly on the console. I know obviously the free version or the flash version, I think, was available on your site for some time. Is it still available on Metanet? Or, okay.
So if you go to thewayoftheninja.org, you can find N for download. It's still completely free. We actually did an upgrade to N in 2012, so it just runs a little bit faster and better, and it's actually in browser now, so you don't have to download it. You can just play it right in your browser, which was something that you could never do up till then because the game is actually quite processor intensive. It's very like the physics that power N are very complex, and for many years we couldn't get it to work in a browser. And actually on PS4, N++ is using a heck of a lot of the PS4's processor, which surprises a lot of people because it looks so simple, but what's going on in the background is absolutely not simple. So, but yes, now you can still play N, the free Flash version, on thewayoftheninja.org, and that would actually be a pretty good sort of primer for the base level of what to expect in N++. So the core of the game is consistent, but N++ is tons smoother and much more beautiful. We added a lot of color and a lot of just refinement of the graphics, but also we added tons of new enemies and thousands of new levels, and we just kind of pushed everything to the next level so that even fans of the original free game would have so much to enjoy in N++, and then people who have never played it have something that they can come back to for basically the rest of their lives.
Yep, and again, like while like, the basic concept of the N of N, N plus, N plus plus hasn't changed all that much, just the additions that have been added to the game has certainly grown over the last few years. Now, we've talked a little bit about what N is earlier in the cast, but just to sort of frame it in this part of the podcast, for people who haven't heard of the N series before, could you tell them sort of like the basic pitch of what the game is or what they're going to be doing in it?
Sure. So N and N plus and N plus plus are all at their core physics-based platformers. So you're a tiny stick figure ninja and you run around levels similar to the Mario Brothers series, but you have a lot more fluidity and momentum, and you can kind of be an acrobat in these levels. You have a lot of acceleration, and once you get your speed up, you can pull off these amazing acrobatic maneuvers that really feel worthy of being a ninja. Like you can fly around these levels, and it feels very satisfying. It's also a very challenging game. Each level is full of inadvertently homicidal robots who are out to kill you, unfortunately, and your job is to avoid them and sort of slip through all these tiny spaces to reach the exit of each level. So it's a one screen presentation, so you can see the whole thing at a time. And that makes it sort of a puzzle platformer in that you can plan out your route before you start playing and then watch the level and the robots kind of unfold before you and figure out if what you had planned is actually going to get you to the exit. So it's really challenging, it's really difficult, but when you It's a skill-based platformer, so that when you make a plan and try to execute it, and then maybe it fails, and on the fly you have to rethink it and pull off these crazy maneuvers just in the nick of time, it's so satisfying when you finally do it because it was exciting, but also you did it. It was your skills. You knew what you needed to do, and you pulled it off. And I don't know, it's so much fun to play that.
And going back to what we were saying earlier in the cast about figuring out the core of your gameplay, and as you were saying about the original version of N being more of a stealth game, more of a slower pace, and then sort of having it click when you sped it up, when you added in that fluidity that you were just talking about, Mayor, it really gives that game a very high skill level feel to it, and it does make you feel badass when you can get through that level. I still remember, like, when I first played, the first time I ran into the heat-seeking missile robots, and, like, you're in a completely wide-open area. I can still see the level in my mind right now where you're, like, jumping up, like, those bouncing square platforms while the robots are shooting missiles at you from every angle. And it just really gives it, like, that crazy feel to it, and something that we really don't see a lot in a traditional platformer.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that we set out to do when we made N, and set out to like make even better when we made N++. So when we made N, there was sort of a trend towards more casual, less hardcore games, because the internet was becoming much more popular and that's what people wanted to do. But Reagan and I still wanted to play those arcade, difficult games from our youths, and we wanted to, I guess, take that inspiration, but also add some of the more modern elements that really make N and N++ special, which is the really smooth physics and that feeling that you get when you play it of being a ninja and like pulling off these crazy things that really sets it apart from other platformers. I mean, at the time when N came out, there weren't really very many difficult platformers. We kind of broke a little new ground there. And I think with N++, we finally figured out how to make everything sing together. So the graphics really work. We added music that we think is atmospheric and punchy and awesome. And you still get the focus on the gameplay that really makes that game fun. So, yeah.
Now, for people listening to the cast, as we've said, and talked about, the game has certainly grown from N to where it's at with N++. For someone who's only looking at the game when it's released on the PC later, could you talk a little bit about some of like the bigger changes to the game?
Sure. So, I mean, first off, it obviously looks different. We've retained the beautiful minimal graphics that we love, but we added some more color, so there's more variety. So as you're playing, you unlock, or really it's called fun locking. You fun lock new color schemes, mm-hmm. and then that gives you just a bit more interest while you're playing through all of the different levels.
Mm-hmm.
You can change color schemes at any time also, which we love. We love to give each player like the choices, enough choices to make their play through the game what they want it to be. So they can choose their color scheme, they can choose the music they want to listen to, and they can choose what level they want to play, which we think is really important. Mm-hmm. So there are tons of new levels. We've been working tirelessly to create and refine and perfect all of the levels in the game, which we, you know, I think there are about 2,000 new levels. We're adding even more new levels for the Steam release, but you know, over 10 years, you really get a lot better at making levels. So I think that's the thing that people are really going to appreciate the most, that we've taken this game that they love, but we've made it even more satisfying to play. And for people who are just coming into it, we added a really comprehensive but still fun tutorial to play through, so that they learn all of the moves the ninja can pull off, and they learn all of the enemies and how they behave and how to get through each level. But they also, you know, it's an enjoyable experience, because I don't know about you, but when I play through a tutorial in the game, when I'm just starting out a new game, I'm like, okay, can we just finish mm-hmm. this quickly? Like, I want to get to the actual game. So we really focused on making the tutorial fun and not a chore, but something that even hardcore fans who already know the series will still enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also added a whole bunch of new enemies. So there's, for example, the evil ninja. That's my favorite. It's basically an evil version of you that does exactly what you did 2 seconds in the past. So we create these really complex levels where you often have to loop back through your past selves and remember what you did, or be really great at sort of improvising and pulling off, you know, excellent maneuvers to get out of the way of your past self on the fly. And it's very exciting and terrifying, and
mm-hmm.
I love that. So there's lots of new enemies. And then there's also a few new game modes. So we added local co-op and local competitive multiplayer. And I mean, co-op used to be my favorite new mode, because we added a variant of that in N+ for Xbox Live Arcade, but we really made it a lot better in N++. And the levels are, again, we've just had so much more time to get to know how to make good co-op levels. And I really, some of them are my favorite, but race mode, which is the competitive multiplayer mode, is phenomenal. So we retooled everything about competitive multiplayer in the N series, and it's like, it's easy enough to jump in at a party, but there's enough strategy and opportunity for, you know, interesting depth that it could actually be a good, it's great in tournaments. Like, we've had a whole bunch of tournaments in the past year, and they're so much fun to watch, but people really figure out interesting strategies in them too. So yeah, so there's new colors, lots of music, so many more levels, new enemies and new game modes, and then just the whole package has been refined and pumped up, and yeah, more of everything you love plus some new stuff, basically.
Awesome. And it definitely goes about like that kind of refining process. I think that's a really good question that I want to ask you about, Mayor. You've been working on this game, again, it was released in 2005, around there. Yeah. So you've had going on, well, now about 11 years of refinement and growing this game. I guess as someone who's worked on a game for so long, how do you, I guess, like, what's like kind of like the philosophy of how do I add more to this idea that I've already put so much into already?
Yeah, so I mean, it's definitely something that we thought about a lot and talked about how we could do, how we could make the best of our efforts there. But there have always been little things that we thought were not quite right, like little bugs or little, you know, the way the ninja moved here wasn't quite right, or just little aspects of the game that we thought we could improve on. And we thought that the graphics could be cleaner. We thought the levels could be better. And, you know, like there are always just little holes that you want to fill. And we definitely thought about how to just make the whole experience better for players, because we knew that they liked the game, but there was always so much more we could do. Another thing that N++ has is global level sharing for everyone. So there's a built-in level editor in the game, so you can make your own levels and you can share them freely with every single other player in the game. So we thought that that would help too, that people really love to be creative in N, and we weren't able to do that in N++. So that was something we were excited about bringing to a broader audience in N++, that people could actually, you know, make and share their own levels. And then I guess the other thing is, while we were like between N and N+, and N+, and N++, we took some breaks. Like we worked on a couple other things, and that really let us get a better perspective about it and get a better, we had more time to reflect on what we liked and what we didn't like. And really, we figured out what we wanted to focus on. And it's mostly a refinement, like a perfection of a concept, instead of like a reboot. It's not really it's not a sequel. N++ is just N, comma, plus plus, you know? It's not like N2. It's like just a better, punchier, more awesome version of this game.
And that's always one of the more interesting and yet harder parts of being a game developer, is being able to take that examination of your title and say, I like it, but what can I do to make it better? And that's one of the things we've seen a lot of game designers struggle with. Either A, they just try to completely gut the game and rebuild from scratch, or B, they're like, oh, my game's perfect, I don't need to do anything else to it. You know, how dare you insult me or criticize my title? And it's just very fascinating to have these transparent conversations about design and about, again, what goes into making and building these games.
Yeah, I'm so happy that your podcast has been focusing on that, because I find that fascinating. And like, even as a developer, I want to know more about how other people do it, because I know we all have that desire to push ourselves and to be better than we were and to make more interesting things than we ever have. But there are so many factors that are preventing us from doing that. And sometimes just hearing someone else's process or someone else's struggle with that is, it helps you see how you can figure out what you're struggling with. And yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah. And one of the things that I did with Game Wisdom was have like developer roundtables. So I actually have different developers on to talk about their process and ask questions to the group. And that's one of the things I would love to have back on. And that's one of the things that definitely the Patreon campaign that I have for Game Wisdom, and I'll talk more about this at the end of the cast, as I always do, but that's one of the goals. I would love to be able to have that financial backing so I can focus on planning these things again, because it is just a lot of work, especially when you have four or five different developers who all, again, because game development is such a tricky thing, there is no one way of doing it. You're basically trying to juggle four different plates at the same time to try to get everyone on and have a conversation. And as I said earlier, when you start throwing in time zones in the factor, it can get just crazy. Okay, he's free at 5 o'clock, but she's free at 2 o'clock her time, and he's, you know, good at 10 o'clock tomorrow. How am I gonna do it all like that?
Right.
Now, I guess to start to wrap things up, or I guess start to end this conversation, because we could definitely just keep on going. For N++, then, as we talked about, it was released on the PS4 last year. It's going to be on the PC later this summer. with that whole porting process, now obviously I know that's probably a little too big to get into, but with the porting process taking to the PC, does this mean that subsequent versions of N or whatever your next game you have an idea for, will we be seeing that sooner than later on the PC platform?
Well, I mean, we definitely hope that that will happen, but I think we're considering what engine we're going to use for our next ideas, because I guess we've learned with N++ that being able to release on the platforms you want to release on as quickly as possible is very important in this day and age. You kind of got to get your product out there on as many places as you can, because it's you want the biggest audience that you can. So being able to do that is super important. So we're considering things like Unity, considering things like a couple different friends have created engines that can port to many different places. So we're thinking about how to do that, because we love our PC audience, and that's definitely the easiest platform for any indie to reach, in my opinion. So that's good, and we definitely need to support that as much as possible. But console was great. Like, we loved working with Sony for PS4, and the PS4 controller is my favorite controller, so we have to be able to use that again and reach that audience again. So yeah, we're thinking about it.
And controller, that is such a tangent I would love to talk about with sort of the evolution of controllers and how we've hit
Yeah.
that standardization point right now. But man, that's a 2 hour, that's I know that's at least an hour and a half discussion right now. But
Oh,
yeah,
totally.
we need to definitely have that if you can get back, if you can come back on real soon for that.
Yeah, for sure. And we should have Reagan join us too, because he's got some great opinions on things.
Awesome.
Next time.
Definitely. Let me see. I'm trying to think if there's any more final questions. I guess before I go into my like regular routine of wrap-up questions for you, Mayor, do you have any, are there any parts of N++ or anything about Mena that I missed that you would like to bring up before we start to wrap it up?
No, I think we covered pretty much everything that I can think of off the top of my head. I think that was pretty good.
Awesome. Now, I guess to start to wrap up the cast then, as we said, N++ is set for later this summer to be on Steam. Now, you said there is going to be that you already have a level editor for it. Are you going to be making use of the Steam Workshop in any capacity for it?
I don't think so, because we already have that functionality built in on our end. But we're still figuring out exactly what, in terms of the Steam environment we're using, like, are we going to support trading cards? I don't know yet, probably. And things like that. So we're still figuring that stuff out.
Cool. And along those lines, then, I know this may be too soon to tell, but do you have any idea of what's next for Mennet after N++ comes out? For the PC, I mean?
Well, yeah, we definitely, I mean, we're working on a couple of small projects now. We're just playing around with ideas and seeing what works, because so as I mentioned earlier, when we were working on Robotology, we had sort of a very rigid game design that we wanted to be able to execute. And because of some of the things that we weren't able to figure out, we weren't really able to get Robotology to a place that we wanted it. So instead of that approach, we're going to go back to what worked with N, which is you just take a couple of small experiments that you're really interested in. So just like little aspects of game design, little mechanics, and then, make them, see what happens, put them together, see if that works, and then see what the game wants to be. So we have a couple of ideas that involve playing around with a lot of different experiments. And then the other thing is, I really want to make Office Yeti at some point, and I've been thinking about that a lot more lately. So Office Yeti is another prototype that we worked on a few years ago that we haven't released yet, but I'm really excited about it. I mean, the name pretty much tells you what you're going to get. You're a Yeti who works at an office, and hilarity ensues, but we have a lot of work to do to get the game to a finished state, because we actually don't know what playing it will be like yet, but I am so excited to figure out what that is.
Have you ever considered doing like an early access launch of a game or testing the waters on that front, Mayor?
Yeah, and I think that Office Yeti would be a pretty good fit for that because we can develop the core mechanics and, start early access for that, and then we can see what works for players and add features over time and then get feedback on them immediately. And yeah, it sounds like it would be a really organic way to develop a game for the right kind of game. And I think Office Yeti could work with that.
Cool. All right. I guess my final question for you then before we start to end things, do you have any final thoughts or anything you'd like to say to any fans listening to the cast?
I really just want to thank our fans. I mean, we have great fans. Fans of N have been in touch with us over the years, and who they send us emails occasionally. And I mean, they've even sent us letters and cards in the like snail mail, which we always really appreciate. I mean, at Metanet, we make games for us first because we feel like if we don't like it, how could anyone else? So we need to know that at least we love the game. We can be proud of it, and we put it out there when we're confident that we're good with it. It's a good game. But the magic that happens when you reach other people who also think it's a good game is just unparalleled. And the fact that we've reached so many people over the years who think that what we've done is great is amazing. And the fact that they've kept in touch, even though it's been over a decade, and they're still excited about N++ and what we're doing after that is even better. So I just want to thank all of our players who've ever played N, N+, or N++ over the years so much because that's what keeps us going.
Awesome. I think that's a great sentiment to end on. Definitely, this has been a fantastic cast, Mayor. It's definitely been worth the wait, I think. I know we were trying to have this like 3 years ago, and it's just been amazing to have you on. So, again, thanks so much for being on today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was great to
Yeah.
chat.
And as we said, I would definitely love to have you back on, and there's just so many more topics we can talk about.
Great.
All right. So, for those of you listening, we're going to end things here for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. As always, if you'd like to support GameWisdom or follow me, there are multiple options available. First, if you would like to submit a guest piece to the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. I'm always looking for new guests, be it enthusiasts, members of the industry, or simply students who would like to talk about game design. Definitely send me an email if you're interested. If you want to stay updated on whatever's going on with GameWisdom, you can subscribe on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer. You'll get my random thoughts throughout the day, as well as updates when new content goes live. To find my video content, you can subscribe to the GameWisdom YouTube channel with links on the front page. There you'll find my variety of video content, recordings from live streams, video examinations, and more. Last but not least, if you'd like to support GameWisdom, we also have the ongoing Patreon campaign to secure much-needed monthly funding. You can find me on Patreon under GameWisdom. Any donations would be greatly appreciated in order to keep things running along, allow me to keep putting out great content like this. So again, Mayor, thanks so much for being on tonight, and I do wish you the best of luck with N++. I can't wait to check it out on Steam later this summer.
Awesome. Thanks so
Great.
much.
And for those of you listening, thanks again for tuning in. Hope you have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.